Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Holistic Nutritionist Podcast. My name's Natalie Douglas and I am your host, but I'm not alone today. I'm joined by the incredibly intelligent and lovely Dawn Whitten. So before we jump into my conversation with Dawn, I wanted to give you a bit of a background on her. She is, gosh, it's hard to actually fit all the things she's done into one short bio. So I am going to summarize a little bit, but I'll pop all the information to learn more about her and her background in the show notes. So Dawn is a naturopath and international board certified lactation consultant. She's passionate about protecting and nurturing the microbiome of the next generation and has a broad base of clinical experience with a focus on women's health through pregnancy and beyond, and infant and toddler health. She has been in clinical practice for 17 years. Dawn has a particular passion for improving practitioner knowledge in the area of lactation, maternal and infant health, and she regularly presents at both national and international conferences and online events. Many of these online lectures can be accessed from probiotic-advisor.teachable.com, but I will pop that information in the show notes for you. And Dawn also regularly publishes papers in the peer-reviewed literature and has contributed to clinical textbooks. And she also coordinates two units within the evidence-based complementary medicine program in the College of Health and Medicine at the University of Tasmania. She also coordinates her clinic's internship program and regularly mentors in her areas of expertise. She is part of the Probiotic Advisor team, which is an online platform providing evidence-based information about probiotics and microbiome-related topics. Dawn has three daughters spanning 7 years to 26 years who continue to contribute to her learning. She practices at Gould's Natural Medicine in Hobart, Tasmania, a 130-year-old apothecary, which has an associated clinic and herb farm. So very exciting. Maybe just for us nerds out there, but that's okay. So in today's episode, Dawn and I discuss so many amazing things when it comes to introducing solid foods, including, you know, the what, the when, the how. We talk about allergies, breastfeeding, baby-led weaning, common digestive issues when first introducing foods, and also I get Dawn to do a bit of myth busting, because I love a good myth busting session with experts. I think that it's really interesting what comes up frequently. So without further ado, let's jump into today's chat. Dawn, hello. Welcome to the Holistic Nutritionist Podcast. It is so lovely to have you with me today, and I'm really excited actually to jump in and ask you all of these questions, because it isn't something that we've actually spoken about in detail before on the podcast, and I wouldn't say that it's my number one area of expertise, so it's always lovely to have someone on who is very much an expert in this area.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. Yeah,
you're
welcome.
It's
great to collaborate.
Yeah, it so is, isn't it? So before we jump into the topic of today's conversation, I really love to ask, especially my practitioner friends, what's inspiring you or exciting you right now in the world of natural medicine?
Sure. Two things come to mind. First of all, I guess, you know, we are, you know, it's been a dark time, hasn't it, going through this pandemic for everyone. And what, I mean, I also just, you know, disclaim that I feel that I've been fairly sheltered in all of that, you know, being on an island off the bottom of Australia. But still, I think there's been this amazing kind of capacity to go towards more simple naturopathic principles, which I find kind of heartening, you know, at this time when there just seems to be a little bit of movement towards drawing on some more of that grassroots natural medicine practice, which, yeah, I guess it's just kind of hopeful and just lovely to see that resilience within natural medicine, how it can be a resource at troubling times like these. And the other thing is more kind of related to my area of interest. I've been watching with excitement as more and more data is gathering in the area of the infant gut microbiome and how, you know, how breastfeeding shapes that, and, you know, the role of breastfeeding in child health and maternal health, because we've seen kind of really an explosion of research in this area. So getting some more answers, and, you know, the research is being done more carefully now, you know, these great cohort studies where they are just putting in much more effective controls and things like that. So I'm really enjoying that.
I love that. I love both of those. And I think it's very satisfying as a practitioner when you do start to see research, like solid research on things that clinically you've seen evidence of for a long time and you know to be true, but sometimes it's no secret that nutritional research and that side of things is not always done, like not always easy to do. So it's very exciting to hear that there's more progress in that area. Very, very good. So let's jump into our topic today, which is all about introducing solids to babies, which is, I find, so fascinating. And I would love to hear, first of all, when exactly do you think we should begin introducing solid food to babies?
Such an important question. And I think, surprisingly, a question where there's a lot of confusion, even amongst health professionals. So it's really great to just start there. I think, you know, a simple answer is we want to introduce solids to an individual baby when that individual baby is developmentally ready. I'm so sorry. I'm in my partner's office and unbeknownst to me has a telephone here.
It's a very old school ringtone. I like it.
I know. I didn't even know there's a phone in here. Do you want to just keep rolling?
Keep rolling. I can like edit that out. That's all good.
Maybe it's entertainment. Anyway.
Maybe.
I hope there's no more surprises.
That's all right.
So, yeah, what... So there are different views, and well, not so much different views, but there's been different messages that have come through. And what's really heartening to me is more recently we've really had much more consistent messaging from the peak health bodies, the bodies that are kind of out there to give advice that on, you know, timing, and who have really looked at the data and really praised that. And they're all coming through now with a consistent message of, you know, introducing solids at around 6 months, with that term around really in there to show that there will be a little bit of variation, you know, kind of give or take a couple to a few weeks. But we're really seeing that around 6 months is the right time for most babies. And that's also in line with, you know, the value of having an adequate period of exclusive breastfeeding. And, you know, of course, not all babies are being exclusively breastfed, but that's kind of the goal, is that we're managing to get as many as we can exclusively breastfed to that around 6 months point. Mm-hmm. And I guess when you what about the individual baby? How do we know when this individual baby is ready? And we can look for key signs with our babies. Important things to look for is good head and torso control. So that's being able to basically sit upright with minimal support without slumping. And the reason that's important is babies need to be able to do that so they can protect their airway as they're learning that new skill of eating. Mm. At the time that they're ready for solids, they'll also lose what's called the tongue thrust reflex, which is a clever reflex they have as younger babies to kind of push things out of their mouth so that things that shouldn't be in their mouth don't stay in their mouth. It sort of protects them. But at around 6 months, they'll start to lose that reflex. And so some a little earlier, some a little later, some it might actually get lost more closer to 7 months. So these are the things that we can look for. And then, of course, there's showing an interest in food, which I think is a little bit more of a confusing sign because babies watch everything avidly and they're interested in everything we do. So that, you know, that our baby is avidly watching us eat doesn't necessarily mean that they're ready to eat. They will start doing things like mimicking us chewing, and that's still kind of like a pre-sign, I would say. Like they're just kind of getting ready. They're practicing before they start. What they may do is actually physically grab something, bring it to their mouth and munch in a way that they're actually trying to get nutrition from it, as opposed to, you know, we know that babies, they do explore the world with their mouth. So they'll put anything in their mouth, you know, from 4 months onwards, but they won't try and derive nutrition from it. They'll more just kind of explore it. You'll see a different kind of like different way of working at that food when they're more ready. And I guess when we're thinking about this readiness, we're also thinking, you know, what do I want? What sort of development needs to happen in my baby so that they are ready? You know, what are we needing to have kind of up and running? And the thing about younger babies is that their guts are very immature, their liver's immature, and their kidneys are immature. So we really don't want solids coming in before these systems are ready for them. And when we talk about guts, their guts being immature, you know, they produce less stomach acid than older, like toddlers or children or adults. They produce less protein breaking down enzymes, so their capacity to actually break down proteins is a lot less. And their guts are leaky, so they can absorb whole proteins more easily. They don't have the same immune defence in their guts. And I think the kidney development's a really important one because their kidneys are quite vulnerable to the wrong kind of exposure. Like a younger baby, their kidneys can be really kind of put under strain when they're given too high protein or we call it a too high solute load. So that's when there's like the mineral portion and the protein portion and the salt portion is out of balance within the food. And that's why breast milk is kind of perfect for these younger babies, because that's all kind of perfectly arranged for their little system. So these things, as much as we're excited about our babies having solids, we really want them to be actually physically and developmentally ready to have them. And we don't want them to kind of miss out on that important exclusive breastfeeding chapter that's pretty fundamental for their development. I want to kind of shortchange them and shorten that if we can.
That's so interesting. And from that, I have about a billion questions because it's so many little things in there that I feel people would have questions on. So the first is, when you mentioned the signs baby shows that they are ready to have solids, is it something where all three of those signs that you mentioned there in relation to interest in food, the tongue thrust, and also the ability to hold their head up, do all three need to be met before you're thinking, okay, this is kind of the time to introduce foods? Or is it a matter of most of them being met? How do we advise parents around that?
The general recommendation would be all three of those are met, and that you might see that earlier kind of interest, as I said, that kind of watching avidly before the other ones become, you know, fully developed.
Yeah, that makes sense. And in relation to, and we might actually go into this a little bit further, but just in relation to how you've mentioned there that, you know, kidneys, liver, gut, etc. are not adequately developed really early on, and that is one of the reasons we wait, in particular a lot around protein. Does that mean, or does that imply at all, that when you're starting to introduce foods to your baby that you're starting with lower protein ones, or is it assumed that by the time they are showing all those signs of readiness that they are at a point where they can have foods that are higher in protein?
Yeah, by the time that they're showing all those signs of readiness, they can cope with those higher protein foods, but they tend to only just have a little sample of them. So it's kind of a small exposure really early on. So they're still the bulk of what's going in is breast milk, but the point is that they can cope with that protein. They can, like, if there's some sort of like infective, like a pathogen or something on there, they're more likely to neutralize and break that down. There's allergens there, they're more likely to break down some of those proteins more effectively.
That makes sense. And in terms of, you know, introducing foods too early, what are some of the risks of introducing them too early to make everyone aware of? So I obviously heard you say, you know, just not the readiness for their organs and the risk of infection if they can't produce enough stomach acid to neutralize those pathogens. Is there anything else that comes to mind in relation to risks?
Absolutely. And if I guess kind of pre-frame that by going back to that concept of, you know, how valuable having an adequate time being exclusively breastfed is for development in terms of, we talked about protection from infection. That's not just, protection from risk of like eating something that had a bug on it, but actually just the breast milk has, you know, through that immune kind of, that hybrid immune system, we would call it, between the mother and the baby. The mother's immune system is really protecting the baby. So having that protection allows the baby to develop. It's not getting, having to spend its whole first six months fighting infections. It's protected from infections, so the baby can just focus on really developing. And if they do get infections, they'll tend to be milder. And then there's the developmental programming that we understand is happening at this time, kind of this fundamental programming, which is driven in part by the infant microbiome, but also the many other components in breast milk, which really are just sending messages to that baby's body around how to develop. And this will be affecting their metabolic health, their tendency to be resistant to diabetes or to be less likely to be overweight, be helping to develop their immune health, and also potentially even their cognitive health. So when we look at the data around, you know, risk, and if we look at, you know, populations in sort of more affluent countries, which we might relate to more, we see early introduction of solids, so before the 6 months. The areas where there's the strongest data are increased susceptibility to infection. So we see when babies, even in richer countries, are receiving solids earlier, they're more likely to get respiratory tract infections. They're more likely to get gastrointestinal infections. And when they get those infections, they're more likely to be severe. They're more likely to require hospitalizations, for example. Breast milk is still protecting them, but it's like that protection is a bit diluted by bringing the solids in early. The other area where there's reasonably strong evidence is around risk of becoming overweight and or obesity. Those are the kind of areas where the data is strongest, and it makes sense that we're probably going to see increased risk of metabolic disease. And as we're learning more about this area, you know, there's studies suggesting, you know, that longer period of exclusive breastfeeding is really protective for the baby's brain development. So, you know, potentially there's some protection from developing autistic spectrum disorders, for example, particularly in populations at risk. The other concern, if solids are brought in too early, is displacing breast milk from the diet. And breast milk, of course, is really a nutritionally complete food for the baby. So if we bring something else in too early, we can affect the baby meeting their nutritional needs. And then, as I guess, just broadly that concept of just potentially causing irritation to their gut because their gut's not ready.
Isn't that fascinating? I just find the whole how amazing our bodies are just so interesting in terms of, you know, our immune systems and our guts and how complex they are, yet how looked after they are by nature and how things are intended to be. It will never stop fascinating me there. I guess another question I have that has just come to mind is, what about delaying introducing foods too late? If someone is delaying them by, you know, 2, 3, 4 months, does that come with its detriments as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a balance, and it's also an evolving area of understanding. You know, we're always learning more. So, you know, if you had me on to speak about this in another year, I might say something slightly different. Mm. But they're, you know, babies are born with basically most of their iron and zinc stores, and they get very small amounts of iron and zinc from breast milk. So that's enough to kind of keep topping up their status. But if we were to go on without bringing in foods for a long time past 6 months, and it will vary very much on the baby, there is a risk that they'll deplete those stores and end up with a deficiency. So as solids are coming in, most nutrients are completely covered by breast milk, but iron and zinc are exceptions. So that's one, I guess, risk that could come up if we were to just delay and delay and delay solids. The other thing that researchers talk about, and, you know, we're still trying to understand better, is this concept of the tolerance window around bringing in potential allergens, and this idea that there might be, you know, ideal time, you know, to bring those in, you know, not too early, not too late. And, you know, if we kept on delaying bringing them in, then maybe we would miss out on our babies developing tolerance to those potential allergens. Having said that, I think part of what supports babies to develop tolerance is bringing in food allergens when breast milk is the predominant food. Like, that's, I think, you know, this is still, you know, theoretical, but it seems to me that that's part of the makeup of helping with developing tolerances, that we really got breast milk still as one of the main foods as these food allergens come in. But it does seem, you know, the data is really suggesting getting these allergens in before 12 months seems to be important.
Yeah, and that's so interesting, because I have to say that that's one of the questions I get asked the most I don't treat children in particular, but I certainly do have plenty of pregnant clients and plenty of friends with babies at the moment, and that's one of the questions I get asked the most, is in relation to allergens and introducing. And there's many stories of people, you know, giving their babies peanuts outside the emergency room just in case. So I guess where I'd like to start with unpacking that a little bit further is, when you're saying allergens, what are some of the most common ones that you're referring to in that collective statement?
You kind of got, let's see if I can remember them all on the spot, but the big eight.
Peanuts is the one I think of first.
Yeah, definitely peanuts. And then the other tree nuts, so cashews, walnuts, pecans, you know, almonds, those ones are probably the ones that come up more commonly than Brazil nuts and macadamia nuts, for example. Sesame is a reasonably common allergen. Cow's milk protein, egg. Yeah. I think those are the ones that we most commonly see as allergens in this age group, but we can also have, you know, shellfish and soy, and that's reasonably common actually in this age group as well. It's important to note that goat's milk is reasonably common allergen too, and there's quite a bit of cross reactivity between cow's milk and goat's milk sensitivity. So, you know, in the past, I think there was this tendency to want to replace cow's milk with goat's milk, but we do have to be cautious about that. So they'd be the kind of the common ones that we be careful of as they're coming in.
Yeah. And how do you recommend that parents go about introducing those particular allergens to their babies? So outside of optimally or ideally trying to introduce them when we're in that window of kind of between 6 to 12 or 12 months and we are still breastfeeding predominantly. Is there a method to how you recommend doing it? And do you recommend sitting in the emergency car park or is there another option?
I think if you've got a strong family history of allergies, so that you've got another child with severe food allergy, or you or your the father's other parent has you know, that kind of history, then it's really important to have some medical support and to be working with an experienced practitioner. I would definitely recommend that to start with. This really interesting data on the value of mothers, this is particularly on peanuts and eggs. The research shows that when mothers eat them during their pregnancy and during breastfeeding, this really helps reduce the risk of allergies into these foods. Obviously, that's not possible if you've got a peanut allergy yourself, but if that's possible, then I think that's a really great thing to do. We talked about when breast milk is still the predominant food is a good time to bring them in. I think also just, you know, have the baby have a nice tummy full of breast milk before you offer the food, making sure the baby is well at the time. So avoid starting a new potential allergenic food when your baby's sick, you know, if they've had a gut infection, even a respiratory infection, if they've got a fever or had a fever in the last couple of days, or if they've just had a vaccine, for example. You kind of don't want any of those things that might just stir up the immune system or make the gut more leaky present right then when you're doing that. And I really like the idea of offering foods in their kind of most tolerable form first. So, for example, peanuts, there's some suggestion that if you're able to obtain raw peanuts and boil them for a number of hours, that'll be a more tolerable form than the classic peanut butter option, which is roasted, and the roasting seems to enhance the allergenicity of the peanut, whereas boiling will have more of a softening effect, so and maybe a gentler way of bringing it in. And there was some earlier kind of research coming out of Israel where they were suggesting that they had quite low peanut allergy there, but they do use peanuts as an early food, but they give them in this more boiled form that kind of, I think, sparked people's interest in that, which so that's a method I use. And it's also a method I use when I'm working very cautiously and closely with other medical practitioners to see if we can look at kind of bringing peanuts in gently in a child that's sensitive. That's obviously extremely, there's some important safety things to be taken care of, and you really need to be working with support to do that. But I think it's sort of encouraging that there's this possibility of bringing things in a gentle form, and apply that same principle to other foods when, you know, when we're kind of a little more worried about allergies with a particular baby. So eggs, less allergenic when they're baked, for example, and the yolk is less allergenic than the white. So we can sort of start kind of with that latter concept. The other thing I think to be conscious of is it's about bringing that food in, and then you need that regular exposure. So ideally continuing to have it weekly or at least fortnightly, so the baby, you know, just maintains that tolerance. And one other thing that I'd mention is that, you know, we're becoming more and more aware of the possibility of allergies developing through contact on the skin. So that's just something to be aware of. In particularly a baby with eczema, we want to be really careful that they, if we can, avoid, you know, them having exposure to potential allergens on their skin, because they may that may put them at risk of developing an allergy to that food. Just like, you know, can imagine the situation where you've got an older sibling that's eating peanut butter around the baby. It's like sometimes hard to control.
Yeah, absolutely. And also just the amount of ingredients that are in skincare things.
Oh,
now
that's right. Yeah.
Checking that and deciphering what seems like a complete different language sometimes as well on the back of them can probably be a good step in the right direction. That's really fascinating about the peanuts and boiling them. And I guess they won't know what they're missing out on in terms of roasted peanut butter, so they probably won't know any different
Because when you first said that, I thought, oh, gross. But then I was like,
how boring.
Yeah, they're not going to, it's not like they've had crunchy peanut butter before. So their baseline is very limited and clear there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you're just really needing to be more careful in those baby with higher risks. But if there isn't really a family history of, I mean, most people have some allergy in their family these days, but if it's, you know, if it's fairly mild, you know, you don't have to be putting as much energy into this.
Yeah. And we are, just to be clear for everyone listening, we are talking about allergic reactions as opposed to intolerances, aren't we? When we're checking for family history.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that's hay fever, asthma or eczema would be the key elements to be aware of in your family, like what the family history of those things are. And yeah, certainly if anyone has anaphylaxis to a food, then that puts you in the high risk category.
Yeah. And a couple of other questions just on that. Is there any advantage to putting, and this might sound like a silly question, but putting the food that you're going to introduce that might potentially be a problem, like putting a little bit of it on their skin to see if there's any skin reaction before putting it in their body, or is it not something that is recommended?
That's a really good question. I'm glad you asked that. I like, the more I learn about this possibility of setting up allergy through the skin, I feel more and more cautious about things like that. Same with, say, skin prick allergy testing in babies. You know, it's like the same sort of thing. It's like, oh, like sometimes there's a value for it because you're just trying to get information so you can get clarity. But just with this, there just seems to be more data really suggesting that that might be how these allergies get set up. It's like the body is meeting that protein in the wrong way. Doesn't want to meet it through the skin, wants to meet it through the gut.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, yeah, that's where I got the idea from, is the skin prick tests, which are often done as, you know, I mean, in adults anyway, that I'm aware of, and by the sounds of it, in some children too. But I hear what you're saying, because it's a completely different way of what would naturally kind of be presented in terms of coming into contact with an allergen. So that's really fascinating. What about a couple of other questions that I know I'm going to get if I don't ask them?
Sure.
What about gluten and wheat? Because we have a lot of people that listen to the podcast who eat gluten-free diets, either from a celiac perspective or from feeling better without it. And I know that that's going to be a question that comes up in terms of, is wheat or gluten a common allergen? And if so, how do we go about, you know, approaching that side of things with our children?
Yeah, that absolutely is. I don't think I listed that on our list of eight. So you can have two different types of reactions. You can probably have lots of reactions to wheat, actually. But I guess in terms of these immunological reactions, you might have a wheat allergy in the same way that that babies would react to peanuts, in that they could have, they call it an IgE reaction, so quite a fast reaction that's fairly obvious. Or they could have celiac disease, as you said. And in terms of promoting tolerance and preventing celiac disease, it's like kind of a difficult dilemma for parents. I think when you, especially if you've got a, you know, a family member who has confirmed celiac disease, and I think it's kind of an evolving story with the data. But my read on this is, obviously, if you actually have celiac disease, then you're not, there's no way you want to be exposed to gluten. But if we're talking about a baby who potentially has, we're unaware whether they have celiac disease, they're otherwise thriving, and we want to prevent them from developing celiac disease, I think with that concept of this tolerance window, I think it is important that they do have some exposure to gluten, so they have the potential to develop tolerance rather than just completely avoiding it. I think, you know, you don't want to do that immediately on commencement of solids, but I think, you know, before the age of one, you know, probably around 9-10 months is, you know, potentially a good time. And key things are the things I said before about making sure they're not sick, making sure they've got a good load of breast milk, and just keeping that dose low and using something like a, you know, like a traditional sourdough, either rye or spelt sourdough, and really just a small, you know, a sprinkle of crumbs on something they're eating initially. And again, that concept of giving that weekly or fortnightly for a period of time. That's what I recommend in my practice. But I'm really watching this space to see what else comes out. Some of the early kind of cautions around development of celiac disease really showed stronger risk when babies had gluten when they had an infection, and if they weren't being breastfed, and when they had a really high dose. So those are the things that I'm sort of thinking about.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because I think it's becoming more and more a choice that people are making for themselves as adults, in terms of, even if they don't have celiac disease, to not have any gluten. And to be completely transparent, I recommend that for a lot of my thyroid patients who have Hashimoto's, and in some other situations from what I've seen work best. However, I think when it comes to children, what's interesting, and I think the question that as at least has come to me in the past, is in relation to, well, even if I am going to make the choice not to make gluten a heavy component of my child's life in the years that I can control what they're eating, is there an advantage to still reintroducing it in that window before 12 months? Oh, which sounds like it is, because you're at least presenting it to the immune system. Would that be correct? If someone was going to make the decision of, I'm not going to have gluten be in their diet for most of their life, but would they still be at an advantage to at least introducing it early, so that when inevitably they probably will have sporadic exposures, there is more resilience there?
I think so, yeah. And probably extending that exposure, you know, into that second year of life too, just kind of, you know, just making sure they're still getting some exposure, low level, small amounts in those more traditional forms. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the really big problems. It can be a very dominant part of the diet very easily. So, keeping it as a low background exposure, particularly in that scenario where when there are known to be family members that are sensitive to it. I think that's
important. That makes a lot of sense. And so, in just kind of shifting gears a little bit in terms of when we are actually introducing solids to children, are there any common problems that parents run into when introducing food? So a common one that pops to mind is constipation. Is that true in terms of that can happen? And if so, are there any other things that can happen as well?
I would say constipation is the most common presentation I see in my clinic around this time. And I would actually say it's more common than not. It's just so incredibly common for this to come up. I think, you know, breast milk's got some lovely stool softening actions naturally in it. And so with that transition to solids, that's a pretty big adjustment for the bowel. And then I think it's about the balance of the types of foods that come in. So some of the common foods that babies might be given, like rice cereal or banana even, and meat, which, you know, has got really important nutritional value, are constipating. So, you know, it's just really important that we're bringing in things that are more bowel movers to balance those constipating foods, and also trying to help that be a slow transition, that we don't see this kind of less sudden overnight that our babies are now having three meals. It's going to somehow deal with that.
Down to some smashed avo and sourdough.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. So if they do, first of all, when you mentioned they're like balancing it out with some non-constipating foods, what would be some examples of, you know, to balance out the meat and banana and rice cereal that's coming in, what would be some other examples of things they could include?
Yeah, so I guess we're going to put things in categories. of whether they were bowel movers, neutral or constipating. I just see vegetables as actually neutral. Like you would sort of imagine them as being movers, but I think they really tend to be a bit more neutral. They don't really push things along. Beetroot would be an exception. That's a bit of a bowel mover. And then really we do need to use the fruits. And sometimes people worry because they're like, oh, my baby's just going to get used to things that are sweet. But to remember that breast milk is quite sweet. So your baby's already used to sweet things. And we just, you know, I recommend avoiding, you know, things that are unnaturally sweet, like grapes and dates and dried fruit, for example. But, you know, raspberries and blackberries and kiwi fruits, as long as they're not sensitive to them, all those fruits with the edible seeds really help to keep things soft. And the thing about fruits, the goal of fruit is to get through your digestive system quick enough so that the seed is still viable to grow at the end. So that's why fruit fibres tend to move things along a bit more than a vegetable fibre, for example. So, and those are really lovely, you know, antioxidant-rich foods for babies to have as well.
Yum, making me hungry just to get up. And what about if doing the food side of things is not enough in terms of balancing out, you know, neutral constipating or movers, non-movers, if you're still experiencing constipation, is there like supplements, is there other things that we can do from a natural medicine perspective and obviously under the guidance of a practitioner, but what are some examples that you might use clinically in that instance?
Sure, and I probably should highlight why that's important to do that, because I think, you know, usually I find we can resolve this with adjustments with the food or just backing the solids off a bit, you know, like making sure we're breastfeeding our babies before offering solids and really just trying to kind of back it off a little bit. But when constipation occurs in babies, they can get quite large, hard stools, and they can end up even getting like anal fissures, little splits in their rectum and anus, which is, you know, painful for them. So then they can start to hold on. And so then the constipation can get worse because they're frightened of pooing. And you can just sort of see how that can be, you know, the beginning of an issue that stays with them through childhood. And, you know, in clinic I do see people where we track back where constipation started for them, and it's since infancy. And you can, and now that I see, you know, in practice how commonly this occurs for babies, you can sort of just see. So that's why it is really important to really nip it in the bud. And if we can't resolve it quickly with some dietary shifts, then yes, definitely working with a practitioner. I find lactulose a really safe treatment to use. It's a prebiotic, so it's got auxiliary benefits, and it's very effective at softening things. And we really just want to keep everything soft and moving well until it's nice and stable, and that baby's no longer fearful of of passing a bowel movement.
I can imagine that would definitely be an issue with children. And I do see constipation develop in adults from them, well, intentionally in this case, holding in their stool because they're too busy. And it's just, amazing what power that can have and what influence it can have as well. So lactulose sounds like a winner there. What about, so I guess this is kind of backtracking a little bit, but it just came to mind because I'm thinking back to when I was in university and we were going through this ourselves, and I don't know if you can correct me if this has changed, but I recall something about there was this encouragement of introducing, like being really intentional about making sure you introduce dairy at a certain age, and then at a certain age switching it to light milk dairy. Now, Dawn, for context, I got trained as a dietitian, so I do not agree with what was stated in that thing. But what's your opinion on the whole dairy side of things? And is it, again, like the wheat where we want to introduce it, even if we're not going to be intentional with it? Like, what's the story around that?
Yeah, I was, like, I did it. naturopathy training, but our nutrition was taught by a dietitian. So I got the same message. I remember that. Yes. And this comes up for me all the time in clinic because parents feel that, you know, their one-year-old should be having cups of milk. You know, they're like, okay, by now I should be giving them cups of milk. Mm. And I think a key message is that breast milk is a wonderful source of calcium. So if you're continuing to breastfeed, you know, into that second year, we don't need to be worrying about calcium. And cow's milk has, you know, a bunch of concerns around it, particularly if it's going to be like a, you know, occupying quite a bit of space in the diet, then there are some detrimental effects. Like it's is going to affect iron absorption, which, you know, as we talked about before, this is a critical nutrient for these little ones to get on top of. So we really don't want to have, you know, a big player in their diet affecting their iron absorption. It's quite irritating, particularly under the age of 12 months, and I think that's part of why the no whole milk before 12 months message was about, is because it does seem to cause microbleeding in the gut under 12 months. And then it's a lot of the cow's milk products are constipating, so we've talked about how that's an issue for these babies. And some of the more kind of recent research coming out around, you know, what happens for health when cow's milk represents a large portion of the solid food intake, what we're seeing is, you know, later development of obesity, and they're suggesting that is correlated with alterations in the infant microbiome by just having too much kind of cow's milk product in their diet, which this is not actually looking at formula, it was actually looking at cow's milk-based products as solid foods or, you know, whole milk. And I was kind of a little bit astounded by the amount of data that was showing that, because, I mean, I guess it does make sense. But I think, you know, ideally we want to see breast milk as that nutritional backbone, and then we want to see a lovely, varied diet. And I think, you know, as we're talking about wheat, I really do want babies to develop tolerance for dairy, and that's the reason in my mind to bring it in, to help them, you know, not be allergic to it. So we're wanting to bring it in small portions and in a nice well-tolerated form, and in this case seems that aged hard cheese, the casein changes that happen, the protein in dairy is a bit more tolerated in that form, so that's kind of a nice way of offering it early. And you're just going to be considering just offering shape, not like a big hunk of cheese, just some shavings into something. Also cooking it can increase the tolerability, and or a traditional yogurt, and again, we just don't want it to be occupying a large part of their diet. You know, yogurt, obviously it's kind of a convenient food to feed babies, but we don't really want that to occupy a big space because of all those reasons. Obviously, it's a different story when we're working with a baby who's, you know, not receiving that breast milk. We do have to come up with different ways of making sure they are getting their calcium needs met.
And I think sometimes people forget, or maybe have just not been educated, that there are other foods that contain calcium besides dairy, which I think even working with adults, it's a constant re-education that I have to give around, you know, like, yes, dairy is a source of calcium, but so is fish with bones in it, broth, sesame seeds, leafy greens. Like, there's a lot of re-education that has to happen. I think we've been, like, there's very much that thinking of, oh, we, you know, a glass of milk, a few glasses of milk a day is healthy, and you've got to have, you know, I mean, I even think back to my childhood when I was growing up, that was very much the message that I got, and I had a glass of milk most days of my life when I was little.
Yeah.
The right thing to do.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, back in the sort of times when there were, you know, probably, I'm not sure when this was, perhaps it was Second World War, but there was food shortages, and they were bringing in milk to schools to to make sure that they were getting enough food. So I think it's in our culture we need cups of milk.
Yep, totally. I mean, I love the taste, but I feel terrible on it. So I have a love-hate relationship.
Why not have a species-specific milk?
I know, right? Crazy. So what about your opinion on so we've kind of talked about what we're reintroducing and time frames and that side of things. Another really popular question that I get asked that I'd love to hear your opinion on or even your experience in is baby-led weaning. Is it something that you're a fan of, you're not a fan of? What's your thoughts around that?
Sure. I love the concept of baby-led weaning, and I did use that with two of my daughters, and it, you know, it was very successful for us, more so with one than the other. I think that, and it's probably worth just introducing for, I'm sure many listeners know what it is, but this is the concept where you're, rather than feeding your baby purees off a spoon, you're giving your baby things that they can hold in their hand, and so that your baby can be in control of how much they're putting in their mouth, how much they take. And so I guess the idea is that the parents will decide what's on offer, and then the baby will decide how much they're going to have. And, you know, there's some beautiful elements of that. You know, it's this kind of, you're seeing introducing solids as this kind of exploratory journey, and the child has potential to learn self-regulation around, you know, eating and their appetite, and there's potentially more scope for sharing family meals together, or, you know, having, you know, the baby just eat something from the family meal that's suitable. And I guess implicit in this is this trust that the infant's motor skills will match their nutritional needs. And I think you know, you can see those lovely elements of it, and, you know, some of the studies that, you know, there's not that much research that's been done, but there is a bit coming out, and there is this suggestion that this method of feeding decreases fussiness around food in children, and helps them to be more accepting of texture, and eat a greater variety of fruit and vegetables, for example, and potentially maybe associated with decreased obesity. But, you know, there are, I think it is that situation where it really isn't for every baby. And the two kind of big drawbacks, I guess, that might come up for parents are concerns around choking, and also, which I can talk a bit more about, and also, you know, the situation where the infant's motor skills and stamina may not match their nutritional needs, so they may not be able to extract enough iron and zinc or additional energy out of those foods that they're being offered. And I guess the third thing that comes up is, but this really applies to when we offer purees as well, is are we making sure we're offering appropriate foods? Obviously, we don't want babies to be starting out solids eating like a deep fried chip, you know, potato chip, where, you know, that might be something that's on the family plate, and I don't really want that to be what kids are starting out on. But that's, you know, something that can very much be managed, and, you know, parents can really make sure they're offering really healthy options. But around, I guess, the choking question, the passionate proponents of baby-led weaning will really talk about this phenomena where the babies will have a heightened gag reflex at around 6 months, so that the trigger point for that gag reflex actually moves forward down their tongue, and that this is a way of them protecting their airway, so that when anything comes near there, they'll gag. And they'll talk about how we need to know the difference between choking and gagging. And I think, you know, that's really valuable, and some parents will be comfortable with that, and then others will just find that experience really stressful. Anyone embarking on baby-led weaning, it's really advisable to do baby first aid training, and I think that's just a good thing to do anyway, having a baby. But definitely having some comfort in being able to sit with your baby and see them kind of working with a piece of food and potentially gagging a bit, like you need to have to be able to have some comfort with that. That was something that, you know, we managed fine in our family setting, but I've worked with many families that have just felt like, oh, actually I'm not comfortable with that. And there's ways of managing it around just starting by offering foods that are much less likely to, easier for babies to manage and less likely to, you know, present a challenge like that. And then also, you know, it's just incredibly important that we're really aware of avoiding all the higher risk choking foods, like things like leaves or vegetables and fruits with a skin on them that can come apart, and because those sort of things can slide around in the baby's mouth and block their airway. Also wanting to avoid, you know, hard round foods or things that can break off in chunks. Things like an apple actually is a pretty common choking hazard.
Yeah, so that I'm one of those as an adult. So
as an adult, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So what would be some examples of good baby wed leaning foods to start with if someone is like they're wanting to try it but they are nervous about that side of things?
Yeah. And I think like if you're choosing I guess the other point to make is you can absolutely do a mix, and it's really valuable for your children, for your babies, to have an opportunity to explore different textures and experiment, you know, have that, develop those skills that they develop when they hand feed themselves. And you know, something that's generally really safe, and like whenever we're feeding our babies we need to watch them like a hawk, but it's just, and you're not going to get much nutrition out of it, but fun to play with is a stick of celery. All those longitudinal fibers really hold everything together well. Also parsnips, because again they've got all those nice longitudinal fibers that mean that the baby can mouth a steamed parsnip and get little bits off, but the whole section mostly just stays intact. And I suppose those are the sort of things to look for. Or another pretty like comfortable safe option is an organic rock melon rind, where you just scoop most of the flesh off, so they've just kind of got the rind with a little bit of flesh on there that they can work at. Things like that can be easier, gentle introductions to that world. And it can be really fun because you're just kind of, you know, you're really watching them explore.
But,
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. I'm getting excited for when I can watch the next baby eat. Sounds like an interesting show. But I agree with you. It's, you know, it sounds like there can be a halfway point if you're feeling a bit reluctant. And I would definitely encourage people to get support in that when you're doing it, because I think being a parent for the first time, going through that process, it's probably even more scary, because rarely have we even seen an adult choke. By the time we're having children, it's easy to just maybe describe it, but seeing it actually happen in front of you, I can imagine, is a different story. So perhaps, having a bit of education and support around that and taking it slow sounds like an approach that might feel a little bit better for a lot of parents.
Absolutely. And that just reminded me of another key point there. Well, two actually. One is, you know, parents do become very in tune with their baby's motor skills, so they kind of can gradually step things along. And so that, I guess that certainly happens. We start off slow and we learn what they can handle, and it's changing day by day, week by week. And the other thing is, I think inherent in any feeding style, we just really need to make sure that we're feeding our babies in a very responsive way, so that we're really letting them drive how much they have. So if we are doing spoon feeding or puree, for example, that we're just avoiding the airplane scenario. We get one more scoop in. We really want to just be checking in with them and stopping when they've had enough. Don't worry about throwing the rest of the bowl out.
Yeah, That's such a good point, because I even remember when I was feeding my cousins, I was encouraged to do that aeroplane game. And yeah. I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking that is the right, like, well, once upon a time thinking that's the right way to do things. So thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, I think it's common. It's very cultural.
Yeah. All right. So my last couple of questions for you is, well, the first one is, are there any other common myths or misconceptions, and there may not be, so if there's not, that's totally fine, but are there any other misconceptions that you wanted to address in relation to this topic?
Yeah, we have covered some of them, but one that I see quite a bit in practice is parents worrying when they can see whole food chunks in their baby's poo and thinking that means that there's a problem with their baby's digestion. I just want to reassure people that that doesn't mean there's a problem with digestion. That, you know, the baby hasn't learned to really masticate things yet, to really chew things up well yet, naturally, and their digestive function is immature. Plus, even adults don't have enzymes to break down cellulose. So if we, you know, just bite a piece of celery, it'll come out in our poo. Like, we don't have a way of breaking that down. But I that's something I see a bit, that parents getting worried about seeing those, you know, chunks of food in their baby's poo. Another one is, I think we probably covered this, but I think just that thing of, you know, that lens change that happens where we stop seeing breast milk as a food. It's quite extraordinary. We've, like, grown a whole baby with our milk and our bodies, and then we start introducing solids, and then we start just kind of watching their food they're eating and thinking that's what's making them grow, and forget that actually there's milk, breast milk is still like an important core food for them. Yeah. I feel like I've probably drummed that point in.
I love your breast milk passion. I absolutely love it. And just to be clear, because I feel like I probably didn't ask you this in a clear enough way before, but for everyone listening, when you say having breast milk before food, you literally mean in the day when you're, like, giving your baby solids, making sure that before they fill up on solid food, that breast milk is, like, the main dish and the solid food is dessert. Is that what you mean by that?
Absolutely. And I think that's also, like, really valuable for making the solid feeding more fun for the baby too, because you can just imagine being ravenous and trying to learn a new skill.
Oh god.
But in terms of
try and
making
make me
sure
do that now, it's terrible.
I know. When you're hangry. Yes. And a really important breastfeed to preserve is that first morning feed. I sometimes see parents dropping that out because they're worried that their baby's not eating enough kind of porridge or other breakfast they're offering them. Like, that actually, that morning breastfeed is like morning, that is their breakfast. That's more nutritious for them. So yeah. And the same formula too. If we're working, you know, our baby is a formula fed baby, we have to be careful not to drop that out too quickly as well.
You've just made me think of another question. I could ask you questions forever, but I really would like to know the answer to this one. Do you have any, when it comes to formula feeding, do you have any preference for the type of formula? So there's obviously a lot of different types out there, but the two that come to mind are the cow's milk-based ones and the goat's milk-based ones. Is there anything that you have to say around those two options, or if there's any other options?
Yeah, I often completely shy away from this question.
You can shy away from it if you want to. There is no obligation.
I mean, I think I would, the things I would say is lactose is really important for babies. So there are some, like, you know, there's some really tricky marketing that happens with formulas. They're all trying to get an edge on each other, and that's something we have to be aware of as consumers. They're all trying to sell what their formula could offer your baby, and just know that, you know, it's very rare for a baby to have a lactose intolerance, because lactose is like the main energy source normally for babies, and they are usually very good at handling lactose unless they have some sort of temporary inflammation in the bowel, but lactose, you know, is important for their brain development. And so be cautious around offering a lactose-free formula. There would be, you know, occasional times when that was appropriate, but that's something I definitely see overused. And the, you know, the extensively, the allergy formulas, the data on those suggest they are not valid for preventing allergy. So that's the other important myth to bust. So if you, if your baby's formula fed and they do have an actual kind of allergy to cow's milk protein, then that could be an important option. But into for prevention, they may potentially be have no effect or potentially be detrimental in terms of developing other allergies. So that those would be the two comments I would make. And I guess the other important place to go when people are asking about a formula option is just to make sure that, first of all, we've covered off seeing if there's any other breastfeeding support we can offer. And then also, if you're looking at a younger baby, exploring the option of donor human milk, which is going to be preferable to a formula option if we can find a safe and secure option.
I love that. I think you answered that beautifully, Dawn. No shying away there. I think it's a really hard question to answer, because I can imagine that not only is every baby different, but every mother is different, every situation is different. There are sometimes situations where the assumption is I can't breastfeed, but there might be other avenues to explore, or lots of things to consider in the context of that. So beautifully answered. So the final question, which will be a much easier one, is if people do want to work with you or find out more about you or hear more of your information, where should they go?
So I have a few courses available at Probiotic Advisor. You can go to the Probiotic Advisor website and see there's actually an Introduction to Solids course there, and a few other courses that relate to infant and maternal health. And then clinically, I work at Gould's Natural Medicine in Hobart, and we do in-person as well as Skype-based appointments as well there.
Amazing. Well, I'll make sure that all those links are in the show notes. And thank you so much for sharing your incredible knowledge with us today. I know that I'm not the only one that would have gotten a lot out of that.